Hello, we're now joined by Carolyn Vilfort. Is that the right way to pronounce your name?
Actually, it's Vilfort, technically.
Oh, Vilfort, sorry about that.
It doesn't matter much.
All right. You're a researcher at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
Can you tell me a little bit about your scientific journey?
So I did my master's at the University of Heidelberg, where I studied physics. And I actually went to Heidelberg because it has quite a wide range of physics research going on there. So I really wanted to see the different parts of physics to get to decide what I actually wanted to do. And then I started taking a lot of astronomy classes, and then I got into the whole extragalactic astronomy research when we had a seminar, which was just choosing a research topic and then giving a talk about that. And that is where I chose Lyman Break galaxies, and I got really excited about the high redshift universe and galaxy evolution. And that then brought me to work with Jochen Heidt for my master project, and for that I chose quasar host galaxies. So this is how I got into the whole connection between quasars and galaxy evolution. So after that then I did my PhD in Finland, actually, because I wanted to work more on the quasars themselves rather than the galaxies. So I worked on polarization studies of AGN to study the variability in their jets. But I actually didn't spend much time in Finland, so I was working on La Palma at a telescope, and then went to STSCI, Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. And that has a rather lively galaxy group. So I got to sit in on a lot of discussion on galaxy evolution. That really brought me back to the whole galaxy evolution side. And this is really what brought me to the interest of combining the AGN, which I love, and the galaxies, which I find very interesting. So then I finished my PhD in 2011, and then went for a postdoc in at University of Florida, where I also worked on the whole AGN galaxy evolution connection. And since August now, I'm at University of St. Andrews, where I'm a super fellow, so I'm still doing the same thing. I'm studying AGN and galaxies.
Correct. And you just released your a paper that addresses that, the host galaxies of AGN in the Candle survey. Could you tell me a little bit about Candles? What is that?
So Candles is an HST, a large HST program, actually I think the largest in the history of Hubble. And what it is a whole of 902 orbits of HST time to study a few very well-studied deep fields. So 902 orbits, just to put that in perspective, one orbit is Hubble turning once around the Earth, and if the 902 orbits would be executed consecutively, that would make it all of 4 months. So it is actually quite a lot of HST time. The Candles group is a rather large group of scientists from many universities and institutes around the world, but led by Sandy Faber at University of California in Santa Barbara and Harry Ferguson at Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. And the scientific aim of Candles is to really study galaxy evolution from the very early phases of the universe. So both to look at the earliest galaxies we see, so galaxies up to redshift 7 and 8, and also to study galaxy evolution from those very, very early phases of the universe down to what we call the cosmic noon. So around redshift of 2 is where most of the galaxy evolution took place. And this is where Candles is really aimed at studying galaxies. And why do we need HST, and why do we need Candles for that? Well, the problem is really that at those higher redshifts, if we want to study the optical wavelength where we see most of the stars, we have to go to the infrared. But the infrared is actually rather hard to study from the crown, simply because the sky background is very bright. So to do something equivalent what HST can do, simply because it's in space and there's no sky background anymore, from crown we would need incredible amounts of time, and basically we cannot just do these kind of things from the ground. So the HST data is then covering the near-infrared using WIFPIC 3, which was installed on Hubble in 2009. And that camera is sensitive to the near infrared, so it's giving us this view of these galaxies up to high redshift and allowing us to study them in much detail. And especially considering the morphology, which is these low surface brightness features around galaxies, which is something you cannot do from the ground in the near infrared.
Is CanDOTS finished? Or is it still ongoing?
It is finished, but a lot of the analysis is still ongoing. And another strength of CanDOTS is that because the data is taken in these deep fields which have a lot of multi-wavelength coverage, we really get a very broad view. So we also get data in all kinds of other bands. We have X-ray, we have radio, we have everything. So combining that gives us a very in-depth view of those galaxies. It also allows us to identify AGN, which is something, of course, I care about a lot.
Correct. In your study, you study AGN selected by X-rays, right? And they had us this Chandra Deep Field South, which was also observed very, very long time, by 4 megaseconds or something like that.
Yeah, 4 megaseconds. I don't even know if you recalculate that, how many months that would be. Yeah, but 4 megaseconds is also one of the deepest observations in the X-rays.
Well, it's comparable to the CanDOTS. That's about a few months, too.
Yeah.
So you study the AGN host galaxies using this CanDOTS near-infrared data. I think the H-band, is that correct?
Yeah.
And so you try to see the merger rate in these AGNs to see if AGNs are triggered by mergers. Why is this so important, do you think?
Well, I think there's two reasons to care about triggering of AGN. One is clearly that as researchers that care about AGN is we don't actually know where they come from. So we have this AGN, which are a supermassive black hole in the centers of galaxies, and we know that they are active because we see them accreting gas, but we don't know how that happened. And I think that is fundamentally a very fundamental question about these sources. Where did they come from? So we really would like to know how they came into being. But another reason to care about AGN triggering, and that is something which has become more and more popular in the last years, is the connection to galaxy evolution. So we now know that supermassive black holes are common in the centers of all galaxies, or all massive galaxies, I would say. But in the majority of galaxies, those supermassive black holes, they dormant, so they don't currently accrete, so we don't see them as AGN. And we also know that the mass of the supermassive black holes correlates quite well with the mass of the host galaxies. This is actually reasonably hard to understand because the sphere of the influence of the black hole, which is the area where the black hole actually dominates the gravitational potential of the galaxy, so which is where the galaxy can feel the black hole in that sense, is very, very small compared to the size of the galaxies. So it doesn't make all that much sense to think, well, how does the galaxy know about the mass of this black hole? So how does it know that it should be correlated with it? So one way of explaining this is that the black hole and the galaxy's core evolved so that their evolution is linked. So, but in that sense, we would have to find a way that star formation is triggered in the galaxy and makes the galaxy grow, and then AGN activity is triggered so that they would co-evolve. So in that sense, we would also like to understand if that is happening, and if so, through which processes. And regarding why mergers are popular for this, well, we often think of black holes just, you know, sucking up everything in the environment, but that's actually not true at all, because they're just masses, and it's actually incredibly hard to feed them.
Yes, otherwise we would see our Milky Way black hole really feeding, and we don't see it, right?
Yeah, we don't see it. There's quite a lot of gas reasonably around it, but it's not active. And the reason it's problematic to feed black holes is, well, first and foremost, angular momentum loss. So the normal angular momentum of gas in the galaxy, to bring that close to the black hole and have it accrete, we need to remove much more than 99% of its angular momentum, and that is a problem, because angular momentum is generally preserved. Of course, we also need gas masses, and those can be, if we have very, very luminous quasars, that can be 10 to the 8 solar masses, which is quite considerable. And we need to bring that to the center, make it lose its angular momentum on lifetimes of the quasar. And this is difficult to do. So mergers are popular for this because, first of all, they'll really disturb the gravitational potential of the host galaxy, and in that sense make it easy through dynamical friction for gas to lose angular momentum to move to the center. So in that sense, they are very good at this. So also, if you have a wet merger, which is what we call mergers between gas-rich galaxies, there's a lot of fresh gas coming in. So in that sense, gas-rich mergers are solving two problems. They provide a way to lose angular momentum, and they bring in new gas. So this is why they are popular.
Why would you need gas to feed the AGN? No, you could basically just feed it with stars, couldn't you?
You would have to disrupt them, and you would have to make them lose angular momentum, which is not what stars do easily, because you need dynamical friction, and generally gas is much better at that than stars.
Great. So there are other processes, though, like secular processes, internal losses of turbulence and losses of angular momentum. Could you give a few examples?
Another thing would, for example, be bars. So you could have a bar which also gives you a source inside the bar for gas to move along the bar to the center. So that would give you basically a steady stream of gas moving towards the center, but generally the rate at which this happens is relatively low, so this is something that would be good as feeding low luminosity AGN.
Okay, so you're trying to see a connection between luminosity and merger rates, because we think that the high luminosity ones are triggered more by mergers, and the low luminosity ones, they could be triggered by several other processes. So you study these galaxies, the merger rate, and unfortunately, you found no high incidence, you found no high incidence of mergers in AGN hosts, especially when you have to take a control sample to say to compare to similar galaxies of similar mass or similar luminosity than their AGN host galaxies. So you used a parameter called a symmetry. Could you talk a little bit about that and why you chose a symmetry? And also you used like a human classifier. If you could talk about what is a human classifier.
I'll just start with the human classifier because that is easier to understand, and that will also explain why I used a symmetry. So commonly, actually, this is one of the funny things. If you show an astronomer a picture of a galaxy and it's an obvious merger, they will go, oh, that is a merger. But it's actually very, you know, it's a bit like kids will learn how to distinguish cats from dogs. You'll show them a cat and they'll say, well, starting at a certain age, well, that's a cat. And they don't really quite know why. You just have it in your head, well, that's a cat, because you learned it over some time, how to recognize cats by their pointy ears or however, and their whiskers and such. So this is similar with showing galaxies to astronomers, and you show it to them and they'll recognize obvious mergers. However, this is something that gets harder as the mergers become less obvious. So that is something that works if the merger is just happening, so you're just at the point where the galaxies first interact, and it will be a very, very obvious sign. However, that merger will move on, and then the merger signs will fade, and at some point, the human classifiers will say, well, that somehow looks disturbed, but I'm not sure.
Exactly. That was the big power of the galaxy zoo, for example, where you had to classify it. They were very good. The humans were very good at fighting these very big train wrecks, as we call them. But as you say, when it was a little bit disturbed, you couldn't quite say.
Yeah, and this is also because there were previous studies using the human classifiers and they found no differences. So what I was wondering is, well, if we don't see differences in like really obvious, just the rates of like massive mergers, do we maybe see that the host galaxies of AGN are slightly more disturbed? So in a sense, that did they have a merger, but maybe not just going on, but just a short time ago where the merger signatures are not obvious anymore? And this is why I wanted to use a symmetry. And how a symmetry works is that you take the galaxy, you rotate it by 180 degrees and subtract the image. and then you take the residuals and sum over that. And what that will give you is, as the name says, a measure of the asymmetry in the galaxy. And the idea behind that is that if the galaxy has recently merged, it will be asymmetric on average. It will have weird clumps, it will have weird structure. And this is something that you should see. And so the asymmetry will be a value rather than saying yes or no, that is a merger, you will get a value of 0.5 or 0.7. So in that sense, you'll have a distribution, you can run statistical tests. So it's more easy to distinguish subtle differences than it is with simply having a binary system of yes or no.
So you compared it to a control sample and you found no statistical evidence of them being different, the AGN host galaxies and the control sample. You also didn't find any increase, as we were talking about, any increase of merger rates with galaxy luminosity, with AGN luminosity, as we would expect, because it needs more gas or more material to be feeding, and it would need maybe a more violent event. And this is in contrast to a very famous paper by Trester et al. So do you think this is because we are still below the luminosity cutoff where mergers really start to dominate? Or do you think there's maybe another explanation for this? Or maybe it's much more complicated and luminosity is only one part of the equation, like accretion rate could be another thing, or black hole mass or something else maybe. What is your opinion of that?
I think I'd possibly go with the both, or it's complicated. I think one thing is that, as I also write in my paper, is that I don't reach the highest AGN luminosity simply because I use Kendall's data, and while it's a very wide field, for AGN people, it's still a small field because we are missing the most luminous AGN, which are incredibly rare.
You had two quite luminous AGN in there, though.
Yeah, but then from two, it's very hard to make a conclusion over
anything. Yeah, that's correct.
Two is not a good sample size. So luminosity might be one effect, and I'm just getting HSD data to study this, to do the same study for very, very luminous AGN. So I'm hoping to be able to answer that. So that might simply be an effect. But if it's an effect of luminosity in which is missing the very high luminosity bin where mergers start to matter, we also must say that, well, the super high luminosity AGN are incredibly rare. So if that is the case, we still have to say, well, then for the majority of AGN, mergers are not the trigger, and we have to find another triggering mechanism for those. So if it's luminosity, it will mean that mergers play a minor role in the overall AGN population.
I completely agree, yes.
Yeah. Then another thing with the TriStar study is that in my sample, I select all the AGN in the same way, and TriStar simply because, well, there are not that many studies of AGN host galaxies, especially at high AGN luminosities. He compiled different samples. So in that sense, it is unclear if part of it is sample selection, because of course you will have studies at the high luminosity AGN, which is, amongst others, your sample of red quasars, which I think your crease is very special in a way. So the question there are these different selection methods driving the effect they see? But of course, if that is the case, we also must say, well, then AGN selected in different ways will have different triggering mechanisms, which might point towards your second possibility that you suggested, is that there's other parameters which drive if mergers are the trigger. So could it be that, things, quasars that are very reddened, that are possibly in dusty galaxies, that they have more mergers?
Exactly, this reddened thing that there are in star-forming galaxies. So the trigger mechanism is actually for the star formation, for the high star formation, and not for the AGN itself. That's a secondary effect.
Yeah.
So if we looked at galaxies that have a lot of star formation, for example, selected in infrared as red quasars, or any another very infrared bright galaxies would be, that you're just seeing a secondary effect. You're not actually seeing the triggering mechanism. You're just seeing the triggering mechanism of the high star formation.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's especially also if you look at low redshift, for example, and you'd look at Eulerx. All of Eulerx at low redshift are major mergers. So if you would go at low redshift and choose only HCN that are selected in Eulerx, they'd also be selected in mergers. But yeah, that, like you said, that would be the secondary effect. And I think it's similar as you go throughout redshift ranges. If you go to the highest IR luminosities, they usually be mergers.
Yeah, but at a certain point, though, at the local sample, at a certain luminosity, there are, if you want to compare it to control galaxies, there are no control galaxies because every Eulerx has an AGN in them. So it becomes quite difficult.
Yeah, that is another point.
Yeah. So it was the same for my very high luminosity studies. It's very difficult to find a suitable control sample because everything would be a merger basically, just because, well, if something has to have such a high luminosity in infrared, it will be triggered either through star formation or will trigger star formation, and so it will be a major merger. So because star formation does need a violet event to trigger itself too, so. So what is you're telling about a new study? You're studying high luminosity AGN post galaxies.
So that is basically an extension to a study which we're talking about at the moment, which is to take the same redshift range, the same selection method, which means X-rays, and just go to really high quasar luminosities. And I got HST time to do that, so I'm now starting to look at the data, which will be much trickier. What I did so far, simply because the AGN are that luminous. But I'm hoping that will answer that. If you go to those highest AGN luminosities, do we start to see an effect that mergers seem to trigger those? Hopefully, I'll know in a year or so. I don't know.
So looking forward to that studies, and thank you very much for joining me and for talking about your paper. It was very interesting.
Yeah, thank you very much for interviewing me.
Okay, sure. Talk to you.